It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios Jeff Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat This Day. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
So let's go into our, we'll be cutting back. Let's go into this last week's news and starting things out here with local and our Washington State Legislative.
Yeah, the state legislature has been working on the budget bills, and unlike us, they can't go on the air and ask for donations. They have to find some way to close the $2.8 billion hole in the state budget. This week, the House of Representatives, the State House of Representatives, came out with their revenue plan. Last week, they came out with a budget where they specified how many cuts they wanted to make and how much extra money they wanted to collect, but they didn't have a plan for exactly how to do that. This Monday, they released that plan, and that plan includes sales taxes on candy, gum, bottled water, cigarettes, and cosmetic surgery. And they want to extend the sales tax to certain services like janitorial services and marketing and management consultants. They want to close some tax loopholes, raise the B&O tax on some professional services like legal and accounting services, et cetera, et cetera. And they want to remove the B&O tax exemption on investment earnings above $250,000 for non-financial firms. And then, of course, in order to get to their goal, they also want to transfer money from the reserve account and from the rainy day fund. So they're relying on some of the state's savings in order to cover the gap. But once again, it leaves almost a $2 billion hole in the budget that they haven't filled. And they also rely on some extra money from the federal government, too. And it's not clear to me or to anybody else that the federal government is going to come through and approve any new funds for states like they did last year. So, of course, one of the major features of the House revenue plan is that they didn't include a sales tax increase like the Senate revenue plan did. So, of course, senators responded, and they said, well, we don't think we can balance the budget without an increase in sales tax. So Senate Majority Leader Lisa Brown, she came out and she tried to save the sales tax increase plan by saying, gosh, let's propose legislation to put a referendum on the November ballot that would reduce the sales tax by a penny but impose a 4.5% income tax on Washington residents who make over $200,000 a year. So instead of the legislature trying to pass that, she proposed, well, let's do a temporary increase in the sales tax now, and then we'll put a plan before voters in November to decide whether or not to impose an income tax on high earners in the state of Washington. Basically, in my mind, that's a cop-out. Instead of the legislature deciding, okay, we're going to at least start by imposing an income tax on high earners, they're deciding, oh, we'll just propose this plan that we know the voters are going to reject so that we can get away with salving our consciences by imposing an increase in a very regressive sales tax.
Well, there's two problems with that, and I see where Brown is coming from on this. One is that any income tax is going to have an immediate court challenge and probably an injunction until the state Supreme Court decides whether that income tax is in fact legal or not. And the second thing is that if you impose a sales tax to the legislature, it wouldn't take effect immediately anyway. And then the other thing is, you know that if the legislature passed a high earners income tax, there would be a referendum on the ballot from somebody seeking to overturn it. So it's going to go to the voters
in one
sooner
way
or later anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. Anything else on that?
Well, we also may see that voters get fed up with an increase in sales tax as well. So that could go to voters.
Let's hope
as
so.
Well.
Yes, that's very true.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's move on to our Senators Patty Murray and Maria Cantwell.
Yes, both of them actually did the right thing this week, which is kind of an astonishing thing. There is an effort underway to get members of the United States Senate to pledge that if in the reconciliation process, the way health care is being set up right now, the Senate, when it had 60 Democratic votes, already went ahead and passed a very bad health care reform bill. That can become law if the House turns around and passes it anyway. The House is going to vote for it only if they then also pass a separate bill that would fix some of the things that they don't like about the Haas bill that would have been passed in the normal Senate House Conference Committee, except that the Senate no longer has 60 Democratic votes. It has 59, and they would have to do it through reconciliation. So the idea is they're going to pass the existing Senate bill as the health care reform, then they're going to do a second bill through reconciliation. And the goal of this particular strategy is to get a majority of senators to agree that they would, as part of that second bill that the Senate would have to pass through reconciliation, have a public option in it. And both Maria Cantwell and Patty Murray announced this week that they would, in fact, support a public option as part of that second bill in the Senate. It seems pretty unlikely at this point that Democratic leaders in Congress are going to add a public option, but they really don't have an excuse for not doing it if the 50 votes in the U.S. Senate are there. So that's part of what that effort is about.
All right. And related to that, moving on to national in Illinois.
Yeah, you know, we talked last week, was it last week or the week before, about rate increases in the state of California for insurance premiums.
Yeah, this, the pledge drive caught up with me. I got a piece of donut in my throat. We have a new winner now in the what insurance companies will do out of sheer greed to screw their customers. California, WellPoint got a lot of attention a couple of weeks ago for announcing 40% rate increases for individual plans in the state of California this year. A company has now announced in the state of Illinois, the only company that provides individual insurance in the state of Illinois, and you get the Tea Partier saying they don't want government health care because it would mean a lack of choice. It's like, what choice do we have now? 60% increase from last year for health insurance policy owners in the state of Illinois. And, you know, the rationale that the health insurance companies are giving for this is, well, costs are going up. And they are going up, but they're not going up nearly that much. According to a group, Healthcare for America Now, from 2000 to 2008, insurance premiums went up 97% for families and 90% for individuals. In the same time period, payments to providers like hospitals and doctors went up by 72%. Underlying medical inflation, calculated from the Consumer Price Index, only went up 39%. So the cost of the policies have gone up at approximately 2.5 times the rate of the actual rate of inflation of medical health care costs. So that tells you that there's a reason for the obscene profits that these health insurance companies are making, and that is simple greed. It doesn't have anything to do with the actual costs that are going up. It has to do with what they think the market will bear and what they can get away with the lack of competition. So, yeah, we need a public option. What we really need is to abolish those insurance companies and throw the executives in jail. But, you know, short of that, because that's probably not going to happen, it's good that Maria Cantwell and Patty Murray did the right things.
All right. From there on to the Obama administration having a tough time deciding where they are going to have the, quote-unquote, terror trials.
Yes. Now, you will recall that the Obama administration announced last year that they were going to put several of the high-value alleged offenders from Guantanamo Bay on trial for their role in the 9/11 plot and various ancillary plots in federal court in Manhattan. And you've had a lot of outcry since then, particularly from Republicans, that these people are just too dangerous for the American justice system. And the American justice system can't be used to handle people that are, you know, so, a bunch of bedwetters is what they are. But we had a report that came out on Thursday saying that the Obama administration was rethinking its commitment to having civilian trials for these folks, that they were thinking of having military tribunals instead. And, you know, you really can't overestimate the degree to which the United States not having a commitment to its own justice system damages our reputation for democracy and damages our commitment to something that much of the rest of the world really admires about us, which is our justice system and our commitment, at least on paper, to fair trials and a defense for everyone. That's not something people take for granted in a lot of the rest of the world, and there are pretty powerful forces who want to see that undermined here at home as well, and we're seeing that in play now with the possibility that the Obama administration might walk back their commitment to civilian trials for these folks. They came out yesterday and said there's no truth to the reports, and in fact no decision has been made, but the fact is that denial in itself means that they're rethinking their original decision, and they might change it.
All right. So, moving on, sticking with national and the Supreme Court weighing in on guns.
Yeah, the U.S. heard, Supreme Court heard oral arguments this week on a case called McDonald versus Chicago. Keep an eye on this one because the way the arguments went, it seems likely that the conservative Supreme Court is going to extend Second Amendment protections to invalidate most or all state and local gun control laws. This is what you got when you you saw George Bush reelected, legally or not, in 2004, and when you had the Democrats roll over on the nominations of John Roberts and Samuel Alito to the Supreme Court, this is what the kind of decisions that we're going to see for the next generation or so until the composition of the Supreme Court can be changed. It's going to be very, very difficult. You have these sorts of decisions where you know the conservative commitment to quote unquote states' rights and, you know, these Tenth Amendment types that we've talked about on this show before that that say that, you know, we should secede from the federal government because they're controlled by socialists and don't like what they're doing. It seems like it's okay to override state laws when it's something like gun control. This is something that's coming down the pike, and it's going to make it much, much more difficult to regulate things like armor-piercing bullets and automatic and semi-automatic weapons, and some of the other things that really have no place on a modern urban street.
All right, moving on, the Powell Doctrine.
Yeah, this week the defense policy doctrine for the United States was articulated by the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Michael Mullen.
The doctrine of overwhelming corporate welfare?
No. What we've been operating under for the last 20 years or so is the Powell Doctrine, which was set after the first Gulf War in 1990, with the idea that the U.S. would only intervene when there were overwhelming U.S. or, in this case, corporate interests involved, and that they would use only overwhelming force, which means to destroy anything that moves on the battlefield with whatever huge sledgehammer you have in your arsenal. Well, that's...
And if a million or so civilians die in the process, well, that's just the cost.
Exactly. And so Michael Mullen came out this week and as a show of restraint, he said, we're going to change that doctrine. It's the Mullen Doctrine now. And the Mullen Doctrine says that we're going to use the military in a precise and principled manner. So he was talking about things like restrained use of force to preserve the lives of civilians, and even if U.S. troops had to take greater risk on the battlefield, et cetera, et cetera. And he had an interesting quote, I thought, when he was talking about the approach the U.S. military was taking in Afghanistan in the invasion of Marja and trying to root out the Taliban. He said, quote, frankly, the battlefield isn't necessarily a field anymore. It's in the minds of the people. Which I thought was a very interesting quote.
Is the war inside your head?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, apparently, it's inside someone's head. But what I found very interesting about his articulation of this new doctrine is that it doesn't explain why the U.S. won't negotiate with the Taliban. If you're going to use the military in a precise and principled manner and try to win the hearts and minds of people, that means you should probably be talking to them at some level. Well, that's not U.S. policy. U.S. policy is still not to negotiate at all with the enemy. It also doesn't explain why the U.S. supports a government in Iraq that has been busy barring candidates from the election just because they might have had some connection of even a very remote connection to Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party. It also doesn't explain why the U.S. Is supporting a government in Iraq that is allowing the heads of Shiite death squads to run for office. It doesn't explain why the U.S. doctrine in regards to nuclear weapons is that we reserve the right to nuke the enemy first, even if that enemy doesn't have nuclear weapons, but we think they may have chemical or biological weapons, just as we thought Iraq maybe had chemical and biological weapons, but we were mistaken.
Or maybe we just don't like how they look.
Yes.
Which brings me to the other idea for a foreign policy doctrine, which is the Mullet Doctrine.
The Mullet Doctrine. Doctrine?
Sort of like the Mullen Doctrine, but it was like the Mullet Doctrine is where the enemy laughs themselves to death at your bad haircut.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on to international and Indonesia.
Yeah, the Obama administration is doing their best to try to find a way around congressional bans on providing arms and training to the Indonesian Special Forces group called Kopassus. Anyone who's paid any attention to Southeast Asian history in the last 40 years knows that the Indonesian government of Suharto, General Suharto, ran the country from about the mid-1960s through 1998, that he was responsible for some of the worst human rights abuses in the world, and his main tool for cracking down on union leaders, student activists, opposition politicians, etc., was his special forces unit, Kopassus. Even after he was overthrown in 1999, Kopassus went on to unleash a bloody revenge on the people of East Timor when they tried to hold their own elections for independence. And since then, the folks who ran the country under Suharto, even though he was overthrown, many of those military guys stayed in power afterwards, and no one has been punished for any of the human rights violations by Kopassus. The U.S. government, however, the Congress, passed a resolution in the late 90s to end support for the Indonesian military, particularly for Kopassus, and now the Obama administration is trying to find a way around that to provide arms and training to them. And I just thought I would point that out because in the next few weeks, Obama is going to be heading on a trip to Southeast Asia where he's going to be shaking hands with some of these very people.
All right, and finally, Afghanistan.
Yeah, and oh, by the way, a quick word from our sponsor. We have 5 more minutes in Mind Over Matters, and we need to hear from 6 more people, you and 5 others, to meet our goal before 9 o'clock. So 206-903-5397. Yeah, we got kind of a stunning admission this week in the war in Afghanistan from Lieutenant General William Caldwell. He's the commander of the NATO training mission in Afghanistan. He was giving a briefing in Brussels that didn't really that alliterate. Doesn't it? Briefing in Brussels. And anyway, he was giving a briefing that really didn't make it into U.S. media, in which he admitted, now many people are aware that the situation in Afghanistan is very much divided along tribal lines. It's a very tribally identified culture there, and one of the challenges of rebuilding Afghanistan as a nation state is getting a government and a police force that's representative of the country as a whole, as opposed to the minority northern tribes, the Uzbeks and Tajiks and so forth, that now control much of the government. His admission was that, you know, the long-term goal of the surge and the counterinsurgency work and whatnot militarily in Afghanistan is to train Afghan forces to take over for the United States in patrolling Margin, patrolling a number of these other areas, where the people in Margin right now don't want to have anything to do with the Afghan police because they're so corrupt and they steal, basically, communities.
Part of that could be because of the way they're paid, the way the central government in Afghanistan pays their police forces is they dole out money to the local tribal chief, who then either pockets the funds or he pays only a portion of it to the guys who are supposed to be collecting a salary. So, of course, many of these people are not making any money unless they extort bribes from people.
Or unless they take money from the Taliban.
Yeah, or unless they participate in the drug trade.
And anyway, what Caldwell had to say was that only 2-3% of the people that are currently being recruited into the Afghan National Police and Armed Services are coming from the Pashtun majority. That's the tribe that dominates the southern region of the country where the Taliban is strongest. What that tells you is that we are setting Afghanistan up for a civil war where the country is going to be controlled by police and military that do not represent the majority of Afghans, and the Taliban are going to be fighting against them, and we're going to be intervening on one side of a civil war. Very, very similar to what happened as a direct result of our policies in Iraq, and we're setting ourselves up for that same problem all over again.
All right, events.
One to talk about today, International Women's Day. This is the 100-year anniversary of International Women's Day that was first declared in 1910. And today there will be a march and rally for that. People will be gathering at noon, men and women, at Powell Barnett Park at MLK Way South and East Alder Street. They'll be marching to a 2 p.m. rally at Occidental Park in Pioneer Square. That's in conjunction with the World March of Women 2010, women and men from all over the world that will be marching. marching today and over the weekend in support of women's rights.
There's also, I can't believe we spaced on this, there's also happening both this morning and then tied to it on Monday, there's related to the Hanford hearing coming up on Monday, there's an event this morning at the Hugo House, Hanford Follies, that will be starting at 10:30 a.m.
And oh, okay.
Monday, there's a major hearing on Hanford and in what's to be done with it at this point, and that's going to be happening at Seattle Center at the Northwest Rooms. I believe it starts at 6, although
that's usually when they start.
They generally have a prep for that at about 5. I'm just doing this off of memory. I'm actually going to have Jerry Paulette's going to be in tomorrow morning to go further on that. So
what time will be in tomorrow?
He's in from 7 to 8 tomorrow morning to bring us up to date on what's going on at Hanford. So talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat This State. And where do people find Eat This State?
Eat This State, it exists on your mind, kind of like the war. www.eatthestate.org. We also have a print edition that you can find where you find free publications around town, bookstores, cafes, King County Library System, and so forth. And if you have comments, questions, tips on anything that you hear here on this program, you can give us a call at 206-719-6947 or email us at info@eatthestate.org.